Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for April 6, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two guests lined up for tonight. First, in about 8 or so minutes, we'll speak with Steffi Woolhandler, who is a physician and also one of the principal forces behind the Physicians for a National Health Program, a leading pundit and activist on behalf of a universal, publicly funded healthcare system. And we'll have her commenting on the supposed revolutionary breakthrough in Massachusetts, which promises universal health coverage, but of course, which won't deliver anything like that. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Jeff Foe, who is one of the founder of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and author of a new book just out from Wiley called The Global Class War: How America's Bipartisan Elite Lost Our Future and What It Will Take to Win It Back. What's about NAFTA and Davos Man and all those sorts of things. So before we get to all that, a few comments on the new economic news this morning. Labor Department reporting first-time claims for unemployment insurance, a very sensitive indicator of the state of the job market. That was off by 5,000 last week, following declines of 8,000 and 7,000 the previous weeks. So now the four-week moving average, which is what most people follow because this is kind of a volatile series, that's now at 309,000, which is a pretty good number. It's not terrific, but it's pretty good. Suggests a pretty healthy job market, but not a booming job market. And when we get the employment report tomorrow morning for the month of March, Labor Department will release that at 8:30 in the morning, expecting something in the neighborhood of 200,000 new jobs and a slight downtick on the unemployment rate, but who knows? These projections are sometimes not worth even the cyberspace they're printed on. But anyway, in sum, it's a good but not great job market with still fairly slow job creation, not as bad as a year or two ago, but not terrific wage growth, but that seems to characterize a lot of the American economy for the last 25, 30 years. The ABC News Washington Post Consumer Comfort Index, a measure of consumer attitudes about their own personal finances and the state of the economy, off two ticks last week to minus 9, which is about the average for that thing ever since it began. The recovery in consumer attitudes that began after the Hurricane Katrina downtrend has pretty much stalled. It's sort of bouncing around now at a B or B-plus level. But some evidence that people are not quite not spending quite as freely as they have been. The International Center Council on Shopping Centers, my favorite trade association, reporting that chain store sales up just 2% year on year, the year ending in March. The slowest growth since November 2004, and below already modest expectations, as the Dismal Scientist website put it. And that is the second consecutive month of a slowing trend. So it may be that households, after spending like crazy over the last several years, may feel a little nervous about higher interest rates, or a little depressed about a weakening housing market, or concerned about the meager state of their savings, or whatever. But spending a little less than they had been. Although applications for new mortgages up a bit last week, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. But again, that has been in a downtrend. And with interest rates heading higher, it doesn't look like the housing market is going to regain its footing anytime soon. And this morning, the New York Times reporting in an article in the front of the Metro section that the welfare rolls in New York City falling yet again to 402,000, which is the lowest level since the mid-1960s. And that's down by, about 60, 70% from the peak of nearly 1.2 million in March 1995. They, of course, celebrate that, although deeper in the story they say there are some worries about inequality and poverty. But anyway, I asked Mark Levitan, who the excellent economist with the Community Service Society, who I've interviewed several times in this show, to comment on this. And he says, the latest decline in the welfare rolls occurs at a time when poverty in the city is rising and wages for workers at the lower rung of the jobs ladder are falling behind the rising cost of living. Before we start celebrating the end of welfare as we knew it, we ought to keep in mind that moving people off welfare is one thing, while offering them a path out of poverty is quite another. And he might have added that no one's really offering that path out of poverty. And then finally, I just want to say a few words about the immigration debate, which has really heated up in the last several months. First, a few words about the economics of immigration. Most studies the effects of immigration on wages and employment find little or no effect. Several economists have done what are called natural experiments, which in this case happen when a sudden influx of immigrants lands in a specific region. David Card of Princeton, for example, studied the effects over the arrival of 125,000 Cubans in Miami during the Mariel boat lift in 1980. He found no effect on jobs or earnings. Jennifer Hunt, whom I've interviewed in this show a couple of times, studied the effects of 900,000 people repatriated from Algeria to France in the early 1960s. Again, no effect. And ditto Rachel Friedberg's work on the effects of Russian immigration to Israel after the Soviets lifted their restrictions. Little effect on jobs or wages for native Israelis. Some studies have found small downward effects of immigration on the wages of native-born high school dropouts in this country, but this contribution is far outweighed by other influences like the eroding value of the minimum wage, the lack of a serious training and employment policy in this country, and the weakened power of unions. There still is something a little disturbing about using cost-benefit logic here. It is very hard to mount a principled argument in favor of sealing our borders. In my utopia, there'd be no borders at all, and people could move freely according to their wishes. While there would be enormous practical problems involved in suddenly opening our borders, the only reasons I can think of to argue against that in principle would be xenophobia or the desire to seal ourselves off from the outside world based on some notion of cultural purity in which like should only associate with like, whatever that means, since even within ethnic groups there's massive variations in worldview, temperament, taste, and personality. I think the sudden upsurge of anti-immigrant feeling in recent months is coming from right-wing politicians who see the president's poll numbers dropping and are looking for something to stir up a little pseudo-populist trouble. It finds a receptive audience among people who are scared about losing their jobs and their social status. Instead of looking at the domestic sources of that fear and instability, it's a lot easier to blame foreigners, whether it's Chinese workers producing exports or Mexican migrants coming north across the Rio Grande. Though American public opinion has turned more anti-immigrant over the last 5 years, it's not a passionately held position, except among a minority of the population. In a Pew survey, 80% of respondents said that Latino immigrants work very hard and have strong family values, and only a third of respondents thought that Latinos turn to crime or welfare. I suspect that this third is a hardcore nativist white portion of the population that just doesn't like brown-skinned people in any form. Interestingly, Pew finds that opposition to immigration is strongest in areas with few immigrants and lowest in areas with many immigrants. So it seems that there's at least some degree of a fantastic component to the opposition to immigration. So let's take a little musical break, and we will be back to speak with Steffi Woolhandler. Fly in the ointment. Never quite understood what that phrase meant, and that song by Wire, who we'll be hearing from later in the show, from about 25 or 30 years ago, doesn't leave me any wiser about the meaning of the fly in the ointment, but I thought the spread of disease was a nice setup for a segment on healthcare finance. Now we're joined by Steffi Woolhandler, who is an MD, a professor at Harvard, and a leading light in the Physicians for National Health program, one of the most prominent analysts and advocates, analysts of healthcare finance and advocates for a national single-payer system. Welcome to Behind the News, Steffi.
Glad to be here.
So I was reading the New York Times the other day, and boy, it sounded like the second coming of Christ or something, that Governor Mitt Romney, the Democrats of and Republicans of Massachusetts coming together to produce this wonderful, innovative, post-partisan, universal healthcare system. Is it as good as it sounds?
Well, I think it's really a hoax. What the bill does is it creates an individual mandate and tells people that they have to purchase their own health insurance. That would apply primarily to middle-income people. And the bill says, oh, there's going to be affordable, comprehensive policies available. But, of course, there are no affordable, comprehensive policies available to individuals in the state. The average individual policy costs $4,500 a year. So it's a little like saying that the legislature is going to make chocolate chip cookies with no sugar or fat or calories. The other provisions of the bill are extremely generous toward the major hospitals in town. They're extremely generous toward the private health insurance industry, since all of the new health insurance would be purchased through the private insurance industry. So the hospitals and insurance industry lobbied pretty hard for the bill. The only piece of the bill that an advocate might like would be some modest Medicaid expansions, but they don't come anywhere close to covering the 750,000 people in the state who have no health insurance.
It's very interesting. You circulated a memo on this thing, and the politicians were saying 500,000 people in Massachusetts were uninsured. The Census Bureau says 250,000 more than that, 750,000. What's the discrepancy about?
Well, the Census Bureau says 750,000, and they base that number on a survey that's done knocking on doors, going house to house, done in up to 11 languages. So they pretty much capture everyone in their survey. What the state did was a telephone survey, only in English and Spanish. So if you didn't have a telephone or you don't speak one of those two languages, you were automatically counted as having health insurance. Now, the Census Bureau is the standard source. That's the source of the number 46 million Americans have no health insurance. And
that's for people who don't have it the whole year, right? It's not through people who go through people who go through a spell without health insurance sometime in a year.
Well, it's interpreted as the number of people who don't have health insurance right now at this moment. Okay, that's probably the most accurate interpretation, is at any given time, 46 million Americans don't have health insurance, and the Massachusetts part of that survey says that at any given time, 750,000 people in our state don't have health insurance.
Well, a lot of the discourse around this issue focuses on people without health insurance, but how are things for people who do have health insurance? Are they secure and happy with their situation?
Well, obviously not. Medical illness and medical bills is a leading cause of bankruptcy in this country, contributing to nearly three quarters of a million family bankruptcies every year. And when we studied that phenomena by interviewing people in bankruptcy courts, we found that 76%, the overwhelming majority of people in medical bankruptcy, had health insurance at the onset of the illness that bankrupted them. But they were bankrupted because private health insurance often fails you. It may fail you because you get your insurance through your job, and if you're sick or have to take off time from work to care for a family member, you may lose your job-related health insurance. But many people in our study of bankruptcy were bankrupted by illness despite having health insurance throughout the illness. But their insurance had so many holes in it, like copayments, deductibles, uncovered services, that they were bankrupted anyway by their out-of-pocket payments. So what happens to many people is they buy private health insurance in good faith, and then the private health insurance fails them. And if anything, this bill is likely to make that situation worse, because Romney was pushing very hard to make the policies stripped down, bare bones kind of policies that are really insurance in name only. The Democrats got language in the bill saying, oh, the policies have to be comprehensive and affordable. But that's actually pie in the sky unless you reform.
It can't be both those things, right?
Right. Well, you can reform the health care system to make it more affordable, but of course this bill doesn't do this. This bill left the private health insurance industry right in the middle. It left all the bureaucratic waste and costs in the middle. So there is no money in the bill to provide affordable health insurance.
I'm speaking with Steffi Wohlhandler, who is a physician and also a prominent analyst and advocate of for a single payer healthcare financing system in the United States. And the people are required under this bill to buy their own health insurance, or they face a tax penalty. There are an awful lot of people who just can't do that. So how's that going to work out?
Well, I don't think it's going to work. Most people who don't have insurance lack insurance because they couldn't afford to pay for it.
Well, you get some anecdotes about, like, 25-year-old guys who think, they're immortal and don't think they need health insurance, but that's really not the bulk of the problem, is it?
Well, Romney was quoting the anecdote about the 25-year-old who, broke his leg in a skateboard accident. But when we looked at the Census Bureau data about who's uninsured in the state of Massachusetts, only a tiny minority of the uninsured were young, affluent people. At most, 13% of the uninsured in the state are young enough and affluent enough to be able to afford a policy. But half of those had some sort of health problem. So when we're looking for young, affluent, healthy, we're talking about 6% of uninsured adults, and so Governor Romney's favorite image of a carefree rich dude on a skateboard who doesn't want to buy insurance is really a distraction from what most people face.
Is there any room in this scheme for the Bush administration's favorite health savings accounts?
Well, they have not talked much about health savings accounts. Those are often tacked on to these bare-bones, high-deductible policies. In fact, you cannot have a health savings account unless you do have a high deductible. But it hasn't been a big topic of conversation at the state level because it requires to extend medical savings accounts would require federal tax relief. They are possible in current tax law, but to extend them further would be a federal policy change.
And what do you make of the scheme that a lot of unions and liberal advocacy groups are pushing, so-called pay or play or fair share proposals that require are targeted at specifically at Walmart, but would require companies, large employers that don't insure their workforce, to kick into a public fund? What do you think of these schemes?
Well, in this state, that played out as a requirement that employers who don't insure their workers. The bill includes a requirement that they pay $295 a year maximum. Now, that for a full-time worker is 15 cents an hour, and that is just a joke. No one can buy health insurance for 15 cents an hour on their job. And so that little piece was stuck in, I guess, as something of a token. Walmart and many large employers increasingly rely on state Medicaid programs to fund health care for their workers. In this state and other states with free care pools, often their workers do end up in free care pools. I mean, everybody in the country needs good health care. Certainly working people need it, but people who are unable to work, people are students, retired, children, everyone needs health care, which is why our group advocates national health insurance, which, is actually the solution that every other developed nation has taken to providing health care. It's not just Canada. It's Australia. It's Western Europe. Every other developed nation has decided that health care is too important to leave to the marketplace, and it's going to be guaranteed through some form of national health insurance. And that's what our group has been advocating in the state, and that's what it would take to actually get to universal health care. If you go to national health insurance, you can simplify the billing and administration and paperwork that now consumes almost a third of total health spending, save billions of dollars each year in this state alone, and use that money to cover the uninsured and improve coverage for people who are now only partially covered. Now, that's an economic model of extending health care that works. What the legislature has done is really give us a bunch of empty promises without any money there to make sure people can actually get the coverage.
Yeah, I was having an extended argument with a policy wonk who's working on these fair share proposals around the country. He argues that some kind of universal single payer scheme is just a maximalist fantasy that's not going to go anywhere, and that this piece by piece a fair share approach is much more practical and achievable. What do you think of that?
Well, the last time the American people were asking an opinion poll if they supported single payer, they said yes. There was a Washington Post ABC poll a little more than a year and a half ago that asked people if they supported national health insurance supported through taxes, and 61% of the American people say that that's what they want. So when policy wonks say it's not possible, perhaps what they mean is that we don't have a democracy or they don't believe that democracy can work. I'm not ready to say that. I think that if the American people hold the politicians' feet to the fire and say we want national health insurance like every other citizens of every other developed nation have, then they can get it. The problem is many of the liberal so-called leaders are distracting people with plans like this Massachusetts one, which will never get us to universal health care and yet is posing as a solution to the problem.
You begin this little memo on the Massachusetts scheme with a vignette of 20 years ago when the Dukakis administration, when Dukakis was signing a bill that supposedly promised universal health care in Massachusetts. That's completely forgotten now, but what was that about and what happened to it?
It was virtually the same scenario 18 years ago. Dukakis was planning to run for president. He wanted a victory, so they patched together a very complicated patchwork scheme that over 2 or 3 years was supposed to get us to universal health care. We had virtually the same photograph in the Boston Globe of all the advocates and the government leaders standing at the State House declaring victory for universal coverage. But the Dukakis bill, like this bill, had no economic base, no economic model of how you were actually going to pay for it. So when it came time to actually implement the universal health care, there was no money for it. And within 2 years, the entire thing unraveled. And we now have more uninsured people in the state than we did when Dukakis declared victory in the battle for universal health care. So it's virtually the same scenario, this time with a Republican hopeful and not a Democratic one. But we've already been through this once. It's not enough to say, to promise universal health care unless you have a policy that actually makes it affordable both for the individuals and for the taxpayers. And it's just not there in this bill.
Now, I heard a story about Hillary Clinton back during the days of Hillary Care saying to your companion and frequent co-author, David Himmelstein, David said that with 70% approval in the polls and strong presidential leadership, we could get universal health coverage. And Hillary's response was, tell me something interesting, David. I never understood what she meant by that.
Well, I think she was saying that's too far-fetched, that itself is pie in the sky, which, I think speaks to the problem with a lot of our liberal leadership is they've set their sights too low. They've set their sights so low they shoot themselves in the foot, as what happened with the Clinton bill. If Clinton had come forward saying, we need national health insurance, it's going to cover everyone, it's going to be much more affordable, both for the individual and the taxpayer, than what we're now doing, people would have flocked to it. He would have had the kind of popular support that he would need to go up against the private insurance industry. But if you present the populace with a Rube Goldberg cube that doesn't solve anybody's problems, that's too complicated to understand, that offers absolutely nothing for people who already have insurance, of course you don't have the political clout to take on the insurance industry. And I might add the drug industry, who's also opposed national health insurance because they're worried about their prices. So our Democratic Party has not been in the habit recently of taking on major industries, even when that's what's in the interest of the American people. Though, of course, they have occasionally in the past, and it's our job to mobilize our constituencies and hold their feet to the fire. I mean, another issue that's driving health policy debate is really the economic issue of the cost of employee benefits. And we're being told that General Motors might close down shop in the United States, that General Motors might, in fact, go under, at least in part because of high health care costs. Meanwhile, there's over $5 billion in new automotive investment going into Canada. Now, Canada's wage costs are the same as those in the U.S., but their health benefit costs are so much lower that Canada is still an attractive place to have a manufacturing industry, where the U.S. is increasingly inhospitable to manufacturing industry, and GM and much of U.S. manufacturing may simply shut down. So I think there's, you know, sound economic reason and some very big corporate players who have a reason to be pushing for more, you know, a real solution to healthcare problems and not another phony solution like we're getting out of the Massachusetts legislature.
And I always wonder why they don't. Why isn't GM pushing for national health insurance? Why isn't the UAW, for that matter, making a big public campaign on behalf of it? Why don't even Walmart might have an interest in pushing for national health insurance? Why is the business class so reticent to this issue?
Well, it certainly GM and even Walmart would be severely punished by the Republicans if they started advocating national health insurance. They might be severely punished by the big financial firms, many of which are linked to the insurance industry. So they have to be willing to take on other corporations in a way that you know, they may not be willing to do either. Though at some point, when you're being faced with the possibility of shutting down, as GM, in fact, maybe soon, perhaps they'll demand that some real solutions be made.
Do you understand the reason for the outsized influence of the insurance industry?
Well, the insurance industry has a very powerful lobbying force. They're a very rich organization. They're very linked up financially with banks and lending institutions. They're highly profitable. A lot of the big mutual funds put a lot of money into insurance firms and HMOs. My sister's a stockbroker, and she always says, oh, why don't you invest in these things? I say, no, I can't. It's a conflict of interest, but she tells me they're very profitable. And there's a lot of financial clout that you get when you're profitable and you control such a big piece of business as the insurance industry does. But they don't. This is a democracy, and we're not in a situation where one industry is able to completely override the will of the American people. I think what we need is much more understanding and much more mobilization by people who are hurt by this system, and it turns out that's actually a lot of us, including many of us with insurance.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Steffi Wohlhandler, who is a physician and an advocate for single-payer health insurance. And I should check out the website of the Physicians for a National Health Program, pnhp.org. Lots of information and links and all that sort of thing on this major topic. Let's take a break, and we'll be back in a little bit with Jeff Foe. WBAI New York City. Well, isn't that arty? This is WBAI New York, 99.5 on the FM dial and on the web at WBAI.org. The program is Behind the News, and my name is Doug Henwood. And let's take a little musical break, a bit more of Wire.
Crash, loosening my grip, be sure to tread carefully, steering a passage, fanning a line, cross a gunfire, crossfire, for great acceleration, skidding but the expression remains man, radiates for all, radio, I'm still in control, understand, I have movement.
And that a bit of Wire's Dot Dash from 1978, I think. Now we're joined on the line by Jeff Foe, who is one of the founders of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, former president of EPI, now a contributing editor of the American Prospect, and a member of the editorial board of Dissent. And his new book is called The Global Class War, How America's Bipartisan Elite Lost Our Future and What It Will Take to Win It Back, just published by Wiley. Welcome to Behind the News, Jeff Foe.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So, your thesis, the party of Davos. We don't have a two-party system. We've just got the Davos party, and they've given us this global economy that is not too good for the rest of us, but it's really good for them.
Well, that's a pretty good summary. The book makes the point, the first point, that globalization is creating a class system that crosses borders. This should not be a surprise. Every society's got a class system. But in our case, and in most advanced countries, and even many developing ones, within the national society and the national economy, politics creates compromises and deals among the classes over who gets what. We had the New Deal for 50 years that sort of framed the American social contract. Capital understood it needed labor. Labor understood it needed capital. Lots of disputes and struggle over who got what. But there was a general sense that both were in it together. But the first point I make is that in a global economy where capital can get its workers elsewhere increasingly, the social contract is not so important and, as a matter of fact, is being ripped up. Elites are disconnecting from ordinary people all over the place. And so what you've got is a politics. If you ask the question, what's the politics of the global economy? The politics is pretty much, at this point, a one-party system that that I call the Party of Davos. And it's composed of elites of most of the countries of the world who increasingly find themselves having more in common across borders than they have common interests with people who share their nationality. And this is just a piece of what's going on in the global economy that I think has really escaped the notice of most people. And so that's where my book starts. It starts looking at this global class system.
Well, funny you should mention a one-party system, because I just happened to be reading Richard Hofstadter's The American Political Tradition, a book that's more than 50 years old, 1948 it was published.
Yeah.
And there's a quote in it, which I thought I'd like to hear you comment on. He says, "The best defense of the two-party system is the argument that while it permits the majority party to govern as it should, it also centralizes the opposition in a single minority group, thus preventing the dissipation of minority energy and sectarian disputes, and checking any tyrannical tendencies in the part of the ends. This argument has seldom fitted the facts of American life, where party differences have rarely been profound and party structure so rigid that minorities, instead of being so focused in either major party when it was out, have rather had to sunder their traditional party ties, in most cases drown alone in the political seas. The first post-Civil War victory of the Democrats in 1884 is one of the few exceptions to this American story of party loyalty, but the subsequent Democratic administration only confirmed the profound uniformity between Republican and Democratic principles. This is written more than 50 years ago about the politics of more than 100 years ago. So what, if anything, is new about this?
Well, I think that part has always been true, but I think both the Republican and Democratic elites have, at least since the New Deal until recently, have had a sense that their future depended on the future of the country that they ruled, the United States. And I think globalization has changed that and has allowed them both, allowed both the elites of both parties to rip up the social contract, which was never between Republicans and Democrats. It was always something that was forced on the upper classes because of political mobilization and the accidents of history like the Depression and World War II. One of the interesting things is that in the book I use NAFTA as an example, and it's an example for two reasons. One, it was the sort of template for the World Trade Organization and the set of rules and the sort of principles upon which the global economy is being structured. And secondly, it's just three countries, and so you can see sort of in the insides of what went on in the North American Free Trade Agreement to get a sense of how this class system works. And you cannot explain how NAFTA came to be by simply looking at the politics, looking at Republicans and Democrats. First of all, it was a Ronald Reagan idea negotiated by George Bush the First and then delivered by Bill Clinton. And there is no political explanation for it. NAFTA was put ahead of Clinton's health care program, the health care program that essentially he was elected to produce, and historically that was his role. So NAFTA had a priority over that, which made no political sense because this was less than a year after he'd been elected by labor and the environmental and progressive groups. And secondly, if you look at the economic benefits sectorally, of who benefited and who didn't, who won and who gained, it was Wall Street, which, despite the presence of Bob Rubin and people like that, is still essentially Republican, and agribusiness. You know, if you look at a map of the United States, that political map with all the red states in the middle, that's where agribusiness is, and those are the interests who gained from NAFTA. And then if you look at who lost, it was the Democratic base. So Hofstadter's point about Republicans and Democrats is still true, but what's different is they both see their future as increasingly no longer in the United States. And I think globalization has allowed them, given them leverage, bargaining power, over labor that they didn't have before.
So why did Clinton become such an evangelist for getting NAFTA through Congress? It's doubtful that a Republican president could have gotten it through Congress, but Clinton was able to do it. And why did he become such an enthusiastic salesman, do you think?
Well, you know, I can't look into the heart of Bill Clinton, but I think my guess is, first of all, there was the money. Clinton saw certainly in the mid and late 1980s that the money that business had was growing and the money that labor had was contracting. Secondly, it's sort of the class, you know, it's the class system that once you get into those circles and you see your life as more, you know, more connected to the CEOs and the people you play golf with and the people who raise the money and the people who are there at the receptions, you know, this is the way you respond in the world. And I think Clinton, the new third thing was Clinton, the new Democrat, really had at least political contempt for the traditional working class representatives, labor unions that had supported him. So he was part and of this process of elites disconnecting themselves from their working class base. You know, he did it with a vengeance.
I'll speak with Jeff Foe, who is the founder of the Economic Policy Institute, its former president, and now the author of the book, The Global Class War, just out from Wiley. And it's not just NAFTA. We remember back in the 90s, Bob Rubin and Larry Summers are running around the globe trying to get all these foreign economies to open up to capital flows and open up to trade.
Oops, apologies for the 10-second audio glitch here. Back to the show.
But one of the things that's going on globally is that it's globalization is not as easy a sell, or at least the kind of neoliberal globalization is not as easy a sell anymore around the world. And perhaps Bob Rubin is still a much better salesman than some of the Republicans are.
Actually, I read in today's Financial Times that Bob Rubin is starting a new policy organization, which is going to generate some policies for the Democrats. Has he been on the phone to you yet?
Well, you know, if you thought the Clinton years were going in the right direction, that's what he's about to bring back. Although, I think that it's going to be a lot more brutal if the Democrats win in 2008 and people like Rubin continue to run the party. I mean, this is a representative of a worldview that has very little interest in the long-term economic development of the United States. NAFTA was the template. The press calls it a free trade agreement, and the language of globalization is still sort of stuck in phrases and words that don't describe much. NAFTA was not a free trade agreement. It was mostly an investment agreement. One of the things that I talk about in the book is how Rubin, who had been co-chair of Goldman Sachs and very much involved in the privatization of telecommunications and banks in Mexico, how Rubin pushed NAFTA, how as a condition for the peso bailout that occurred a year after NAFTA, he pushed the Mexicans into accelerating their opening up their banking system to foreign investment. And after he left the Treasury, he goes to Citigroup, and a very short time after the date at which Mexicans agreed that their 51% of their banks could be owned by foreigners, Citigroup becomes the largest banker in Mexico.
And just by coincidence, Bob Rubin now works for Citigroup, right?
Yeah, no, he went from Treasury, went to Citigroup, became the head of the executive committee, and negotiated the deal to buy the banks. One of the other pieces of this is that the banks were privatized by Carlos Salinas, who was Washington's favorite third world leader back in the late 80s and early 90s. He privatized it to business cronies They bought, for example, Banamex for something like $3 billion, just your average Mexican putting up $3 billion for a bank. They failed to run it. And so the Mexican government bailed it out and is still subsidizing banks down there at a huge rate. The bank's now owned by Citigroup, and they're still getting the subsidies. So that, you know, it was a... This is called free trade. Now, if you can find free trade in that, you know, in that store, you get a free book from me. It
sounds like socialism for the rich.
Exactly. Well, it's exactly what it is, and that's, of course, one of the problems is that the language that we have doesn't capture that. We talk about the Chinese threat, for example. So we have this notion of, you know, the China versus the United States. But if you start to decompose what that China threat is, it's a business deal, a business alliance between the Chinese commissars who provide the labor, often at the point of a bayonet, and U.S. and other multinational corporations who provide the technology and the capital. So is that China or is that something else? You know, we also get confused, and we use this old language when we talk about global poverty. It's always rich countries versus poor countries. But one of my inspirations, the late Michael Harrington, once reminded me that there are rich people in poor countries and poor people in rich countries. And that fact and the alliance between the rich and the rich in rich and poor countries sort of gets lost in the debate. Not by accident, I don't think.
And although a lot of people focus on the damage that NAFTA has supposedly done to the United States, it really did. It's been a very bad deal for Mexico, right?
Well, it's been a good deal for those on the top. Jorge Castañeda, who later became foreign minister of Mexico, commented in 1995 that NAFTA was a deal negotiated by the rich and powerful, let's use his phrase, the rich and powerful of all three countries, leaving out ordinary people. And that's exactly what happened. If you ask the question, well, who won and who lost from NAFTA? Was it Canada, the United States, or Mexico? That's really not a very useful question because the rich and powerful, big surprise, in all three countries won, and ordinary people took it on the chin, and the Mexicans particularly. Real wages by the end of 12 years were barely back to where they were in Mexico when they started. And in the farm sector, several million Mexican farmers got blown out of the water by agribusiness corn from the United States and wheat from Canada. They let down the barriers, and there's no way that these little farmers, who were producing enough corn for Mexico, but there's no way that they could compete against the heavily subsidized, heavily government-subsidized agribusiness in the U.S. especially. So they lost their farms. They got driven off the farmland, and there were no jobs in the cities for them. There are a few jobs at the Mexican border in the so-called maquiladoras, but it is no surprise that migration, illegal immigration, increased more than 2.5 times between NAFTA and now. And this is after Bill Clinton in 1993 promised that if we pass NAFTA, illegal migration would no longer be a problem. Carlos Salinas came to Washington at one point and said, well, what would you rather have, our tomatoes or our tomato pickers? And it turns out, of course, we got both, and we got a huge number of people who were literally driven out of their homes in Mexico, couldn't find jobs, and in desperation across the border. More than 400 lost their lives last year. And yet, the immigration debate that we've had over the last, well, we've been having it for several months, but it's been all over the newspapers, and it's absorbed Washington for the last couple of weeks. That immigration debate has no reference to what happened in Mexico because of NAFTA. And of course, what it did was it benefited the elites on both sides. Here, business gets the opportunity to have a large supply of cheaper labor and to push down the wages, especially at the lower end of the wage scale. And in Mexico, the elites get rid of energetic, ambitious people who otherwise might be causing political trouble because of their frustration over the lack of economic opportunities, gets rid of them. They come to the U.S. and then gets the remittances, $17 billion a year, that they send back to their families. And that relieves the elites in Mexico from having to spend too much money on social programs.
We've only got a few minutes left, so let me get to the what is to be done part of this. you've laid out the pathologies. This has been a global class war, as you put it, but it's been a war fought mainly from above, aimed at those below. How do those below, what we used to call the masses, fight back?
Well, I mean, there's several pieces to it, but I think the thing that for me is most important is since globalization is not going to go away, and in North America where we are, NAFTA's not going to you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. But the real problem is, how do you get a social contract in the global economy? Now, I quite frankly can't figure out how you would do that in my lifetime for the world of 2.5 billion people in 200 countries. But I can imagine how we could start doing it here and in other places on a sort of a regional basis. So what I think we need to do is we need to have a class consciousness that crosses borders. And here in North America, we only have 3 countries. And so I think that the part of the political answer is for the ordinary people, to use Castaneda's phrase, the ordinary people to begin to see themselves as having more in common with each other across borders than they do with people in the 55th floor of the bank building in their capital city. So I propose that we develop a politics that would start agitating for a social contract for North America. It's going on in Europe. There's a struggle between those who want to maintain and expand the traditional welfare state in Europe and those who want to destroy that for a laissez-faire, what they call American model, which is really a model of 19th century economics. In Mercosur, in the south of South America, there are efforts by political parties, labor unions, to try to develop a popular notion of cross-border solidarity. There's definitely solidarity at the top. The history of NAFTA and the history of globalization tells us that. The party of Davos knows who it is, and they want to wage class warfare, and they want to win it. So I think it's now time for a consciousness for the majority of people who relentlessly are getting their living standards undercut by globalization to create a new kind of politics, and that's I think, the main new thing I have to contribute at the end of the book.
So, workers of the world unite, as somebody once said. Right?
Yeah, you could say that.
Thank you for joining us, Jeff Foe.
Thank you.
Jeff Foe, founder of the Economic Policy Institute, former president of the EPI, and author of the book Global Class War, just out from Wiley. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and then on to the evening. I will be back next week. I know I promised Beverly Wright to talk about New Orleans, but she was unavailable, so I'm going to try again for next week, but we'll see. And let's go out with a little bit more of Wired. This one is going out to, you know who you are. And till next week, goodbye.